Okay, thank you for bearing with me. I think this is the last research talk of the meeting, is that right?
Sure.
So, it's kind of appropriate that I'm telling you a cider-based story. As you can see from the tiny, tiny acknowledgements at the bottom of here, it says this work started at the 2016 Cider Workshop. And so this talk is mostly about work that I did with Sana and with Ved, and it was strongly fueled by coffee in the courtyard and coffee at the Santa Inez apartments. And I'm going to tell you a story about the outer core. And what we've done is we've made this new model, which we've called Epoch, which is kind of like epic, but it's Epoch. We found the elastic parameters of the outer core, as well as seismologists.
Just change it to in the outer core, and then you have Epoch.
No, but that's later for the inner core.
Yeah. Oh. And so I'm going to try and keep this fairly brief, because I know people are relatively keen to go to the barbecue. But I also know that we haven't talked about core a lot. We've spent a lot of time talking about the mantle. We've talked about all that crust stuff that is apparently on the top and gets subducted. But we haven't spent a huge amount of time talking about the outer core, and it's a really important part of our planet. If we want to think about where the magnetic field is generated, we need to look to the core. If we want to think about where some of the heat that the mantle takes, we need to look to the core. And yet, we still don't know enough to satisfy at least me about what the core is made from. So, what do we know? Where can we start? Well, you can go back to Francis Birch's tome of a paper from 1952, and you can say, core should be heavy, mostly iron. That's great, we've got some geophysics in there. And we end up with a core which is probably something like 90% iron nickel. I'm a seismologist, so I'm going to pretend that iron is the same as nickel. And 10% lighter elements. And many people in the room would love to know exactly what these lighter elements are. And we're not going to speculate too much about that here today. And we can also look at the composition of iron meteorites. So this is the Henbury meteorite. This one was found in Australia in 1926. This is the Grosvenor meteorite. I don't remember when this one was found, but it was found in Antarctica. It turns out Antarctica is a great hunting ground for meteorites. If you're in the desert and you see a rock, it's a rock. If you're standing on top of an ice field and you see one solitary rock, it could be a meteorite. So we have these samples, and that's lovely, and they're very pretty. And if you're lucky, your university will let you borrow them and play with them. But these aren't samples of our core. They're samples of the core of some planetesimal that clearly had a messy history because its innards are on a screen in front of us. That's not great. So these aren't quite what we're looking for. They're also solid. And if we want to talk about the outer core, we really need to think about the properties of a liquid at very high temperature and pressure. So clearly people have thought about the core before. And we can look at pre-existing models. So we have velocity models, shown in this panel over here, and density models shown in this panel over here. The model that most people will be familiar with when you want to think about a velocity and you want to think about a density is Prem. Prem is great. I've been recently calling Prem like venerable. It's a venerable model of the Earth. That's got me into trouble with people who are older than Prem. Nonetheless, Prem is a very well-regarded model of the Earth. But when we look at the velocities described by Prem, we see significant inconsistencies just in the 1D models, especially at the top and bottom of the outer core. And when you look at the things I have chosen to plot up for density, we actually see that Prem is the youngest of these models. So clearly there hasn't been a great deal of recent re-evaluation of the combined density and velocity in the outer core. And as seismologists, that's something that we think we can work with. So the pre-existing models have been parameterized for simplicity. They are not grounded in physics. We should trust the mineral physicists in the room who say they know what happens when we swish stuff. So it would be nice if we could use some of that physics to inform the model we make. They're based on older data. Some of the data in Prem is from the 1960s. Some of it's in personal communications, and nobody really knows what's there. There is this disagreement between some of the body wave, more recent models of velocity in the outer core, and some of these normal mode-based models. If we're seeing one Earth, that's a problematic disagreement. And that means that as seismologists, we have made models which aren't super useful for anybody who wants to use them for something. So if you're a geodynamicist and want to model the properties of the core, or if you're a mineral physicist and want to say, is what's in my sample similar to the core, the models we have for you right now aren't doing a tremendous job. So what we would like to do is make a new model of the outer core. And with carefully targeted bullet points, we would like to use new data, not old data. Specifically, we'd like to use new normal mode data. We'd like to think about the mineral physics of what's going on. So we're actually going to find some equation of state parameters as well. We would like to find a model which does a better job than PREM. If we create a model at the end of the day, it does a worse job than PREM, then we're not very good scientists, or we've messed up somehow. And we'd like to therefore make a model which is useful, which can be used by the mineral physicists, by the dynamicists. Could it be used by the geochemists? I'm not sure. You could ask them. But we'd like to make a model which is useful for other scientists. And the tool we're going to use are going to be these normal mode oscillations. Does everyone remember these from a fortnight ago? We've got these whole planetary vibrations. And if I was willing to wait a while to persuade you, I'd get you all to dance like some of these normal modes. These normal mode oscillations that we're going to be using to look at the properties of the outer core. We're not going to use any of these toroidal or twisting normal modes because you can't shear a liquid, so there's no point in using those. And we are instead going to use normal modes like these spheroidal ones with their periods, which are often measured in the millihertz. We're going to be relatively conservative in which normal modes we use. This is the family of all the normal modes which should be under 10 millihertz. But there are some modes we're going to choose not to use. This is a slightly controversial choice, but we're convinced it's the right one. We're not going to use modes which are affected by coupling due to inner core anisotropy. So we haven't talked much about the inner core, so we got to Dan's talk yesterday, and Dan gave us a lovely story about what we know from body waves. Turns out, though, from normal modes, we also have some understanding of the anisotropy in the inner core. And if we let mode coupling happen for one of four different models, so each of these panels is a different model of inner core anisotropy, and as you go from red, we've got the inner core anisotropy model completely switched on, all the way to purple, where we've got the anisotropy model completely switched off, we see significant changes in the frequencies of these normal modes that care about the inner core. We also see changes in how quickly the modes decay, and those pretty rainbow patterns are different for each of those four different models. So as a normal mode seismologist, I'm going to say that we don't really have a clue what's going on here in terms of the full coupling behavior of these normal modes. A lot of people are working on this, but because we don't have an answer, we can't use those data yet. We know they're affected by the inner core, and nobody can tell us how, including me. We're also not going to use those stony modes, and these are something that Guy talked about in his normal modes talk. These stony modes should be wonderful, because they really care about the area around the core mantle boundary. And yet you measure these stony modes by looking at them combined with another mode. Okay? So again, you've got these cross-coupling phenomena, and I think it was fairly clear from the end of Guy's talk that we're not quite sure what's going on at the core mantle boundary either. So we're going to try to build the best model we can, and we're not going to use these likely contaminated data. So this is probably very equivalent to some of the stuff that Curtis just told us, except it's which normal modes you choose, not which geochemical samples do you choose. And after we've made these careful choices, we still have plenty of modes. We've assembled a data set of 319 modes. That's a lot of mode observations. They're going to dance around like that, and we're going to take them from the most recent observations first. Where we need to, we're going to go back in the literature a bit to fill in this catalogue. So we have some input data. We have normal mode data. We would like to understand the physical properties of the outer core. And this is how we're going to go about doing that. We're going to say that we expect the outer core to be a well-mixed liquid. You can make some arguments as to whether you expect that to be true at the very top of the outer core and the very bottom of the outer core, and we'll get there at the end of the talk. But we expect it to be mostly a well-mixed liquid. And so we're going to make the simplifying assumption that we can look for an isentropic equation of state to describe our data. So there's one material, it's well-mixed, and we think it should be isentropic. We're just looking for the adiabatic behavior of the outer core. We have VED on our team, so we're going to carry out a Bayesian parameter space search. And we're going to try and find the coefficients of that equation of state. So that's what we're actually seeking to start with. We have Sana on the team, so we're going to use Burnman next. You can see how this project developed, can't you? So we're going to take the equation of state that we found, and we're going to say, okay, for this equation of state, what should the velocities in the outer core be? What should the densities in the outer core be? And then with the normal mode seismologists on the team, we can then predict the normal mode frequencies. So that's our workflow. That's what we're actually doing. there is a small technical hitch here. We ran many test inversions. And a bunch of these many test inversions told us that we can't independently constrain the molar mass of what's in the outer core and the molar volume of what's in the outer core. And when we did all of these many tests, we got this beautiful linear trade-off between molar mass and molar volume, because what the modes were actually telling us about was the molar density of the stuff in the outer core. So we've chosen to fix our molar mass, but if you like a different molar mass, if there's something else you favour, you can actually refit the results of our work. And if anybody's interested in doing that, you can just talk to me. And so when we do that, we find our equation of state parameters. What you're seeing here are histograms showing the frequency of each of these equation of state parameters. And then on the off-diagonal plots, you're seeing some trade-offs. These trade-offs look kind of terrifying to start with. So we can start to put some physical understanding into what do they mean. So this column here is telling us about bulk modulus. This row here is telling us about the derivative of bulk modulus. And so this significant trade-off in this panel is telling us something we should know from physics. If you're going to have bulk modulus at zero pressure and extrapolate it all the way to the pressure of the outer core, you can either have a high bulk modulus and not have to extrapolate it too much, or you can start with a lower value and need to extrapolate it a lot with a pressure derivative. Either way, you're going to end up with the same sorts of values. So although these figures look like they have trade-offs, we actually have fairly well-defined minima in our equation of state space. And that's really exciting, because what we're looking for is an equation of state and also the density and velocity that those correspond to. And when we first started talking about doing this work, a lot of people said, why are you doing this Bayesian thing? And it wasn't a really good answer to say, because Ved thinks it's a really good idea. We tried that first. Instead, we were doing this thing because it was important and necessary. And so what I have is a very, very information-rich plot, which Ved has told me has been plotted by a genius. You can guess who plotted that plot. But it's actually really important, because what we would want to know is, if you just did a simple, normal in seismology, linearized inversion, could you get the right answer? And so what we've done is we've plotted up some colors which say, if the mistake you make by linearizing your problem is a very small error that you introduce, you should have a pale blue color. If the mistake that you make when you linearize your data is as big as the measurement uncertainty, you should have like a mid-purple color. And if the mistake that you make by linearizing the data is even bigger than all of your measurement uncertainty, you're going to get a bright color. And so we see that for many of the modes we care about, and especially many of the modes which care about the outer core, doing a simple standard linearized inversion doesn't do the job. It's going to give you real problems, and those problems are going to be much bigger than any of your measurement uncertainties. So what we've done instead is to explore all our parameter space, and that also lets us do something which is useful in seismology, which is to take into account the fact that eigenfunctions can change when you change your Earth model. So there are a few good reasons for doing this, and we're really happy with that choice because it's given us this model. So for the mineral physicists, bulk modulus is a little bit smaller than that for Prem. But what we actually find is that the pressure derivative of that is larger than Prem. So what we have is a material which is more compressible when you squish it all the way into the outer core. And you can combine that with the fact that the density you get at zero pressure is lower than what Prem would have. So what you have is something which might have more light elements than what we used to think was present in the outer core. And we're not defining which light elements we think we have, but we may have found an outer core which is better described with some more light elements in there. We've only got three parameters for our model. We've had to fix that molar mass. We have three parameters. Prem has eight parameters to describe it. And so we can plot up our model with those parameters. We can say Prem is going to be in orange. We can say our model, Epoch Vinet, we've used a Vinet equation of state in this case, is going to be in green. And you can just about see some dashed lines. The shaded lines and dashed lines contain 66% of our models in our model space and 95% of our models in our model space. We find that our model, Epoch Vinet, fits the normal mode data about a third better than Prem. So we're quite excited. We think we did a good job. If you look at the data which particularly cares about the outer core, we fit it more than 70% better than Prem. So we're happy that our model is actually doing a really good job. We find that if we look at the top of the outer core, our model is seismically slower and in Prem, and I'll come back to that later. We have a problem with our model, and we're not ashamed to admit it. Our density is higher throughout than Prem. So right now, as it stands, if you plug Prem, which is what we've used for the rest of the Earth, together with our outer core, you find a model which is more massive than the mass of the Earth.
By about half a percent or something?
Yeah, that sort of order of magnitude. I don't remember the exact number, maybe something. No, neither of my co-authors remember the exact number.
0.3%.
Yeah, so it's a little bit heavier, and we're also breaking the moment of inertia a bit. These modes, these data fit the modes really well, so clearly we need to be compensating for that mass anomaly somewhere else. They've run some calculations, and you can already start to move towards compensating for that if you take a Prem crust and you switch it for a crust 2.0 crust 5.0 crust, if you just even switch the crust to Prem. So we're not saying we've solved anything, but we're saying we're doing a much better job than had been done before.
What happens if you, have you tried putting the mass and the inertia into the inversion as a contribution to the
rest,
and if so, what happens?
So you find that you end up basically deciding what trade-off you would like to have. So how much would you like to weight that contribution? And so you can make some restrictions, and your model moves a bit towards Prem, or you can say that mass and moment of inertia is somewhere else. I would like to blame the lower mantle for that. I mean, that's something that we could do, and we've chosen not to do at the moment. We're just trying to solve here. There are ways you can get the density down, but I'm not planning to talk about those today.
I'm a little confused. How does the higher density square with the what you said earlier about the more light elements?
That was my response when we got these results. How do these things work together? So what happens is you have something which is lower density at room temperature and pressure, but it's more compressible. So when you ramp it all the way up to your 300 gigapascals at the bottom of the outer core, you've squished it much more, and so overall you have more density, but your zero pressure reference is one which has less density per mole.
Lower density at zero pressure.
Really, really counterintuitive.
But I think so my interpretation of that would be that that's just a reflection of the very long extrapolation that you have to do from where your normal mode data is sensitive all the way back to zero pressure, which is really far away. And my conclusion from this is that your outer core has less light elements than Prem does, not more. Right? So, and I wouldn't pay so much attention to the long extrapolation to zero pressure.
Well, so I think... Go on, jump in. I know you want to.
I guess it's a sense that the gradient across the outer core is constrained in some way. So it says something about the behavior of the material, yeah. I think.
And so we've got some more detailed analyses, so if you'd like to talk about this later, we'd love to.
So if I might just add up?
Yeah.
The liquid structure changes a lot for all of this core system. Like if you really can't extrapolate back.
We've used the Vinet equation of state, and should you even be using that for a liquid at all? This is the best...
It's really not the same structure material.
Yeah, so this is the best equation state we've used. In two slides' time, I have the same thing with the Birch-Murnahan. You have the same answers. But again, what does it mean at zero pressure? Well, once you've taken what we have in our outer core to zero pressure, you don't have what we have in our outer core anymore. That's exactly what you're saying.
So is it possible for you to trade off between velocity and a density discrepancy?
Yes.
You matched the velocity, but you didn't match density as well.
We're not trying to match.
No, we're not. We don't use Prem at all, and we don't have the same parameterization as Prem.
Could it be that you change the velocity, change the K prime K, and then have the density be more reasonable? Because having 0.3% more massive is not acceptable.
I think it's not acceptable if you believe that the rest of the planet looks like Prem. But if you believe that we don't know everything about the rest of the planet, given the density changes we're seeing here in the outer core that better fit the data, then you could be less concerned about that. But I would like us to know the mass of the planet properly, and I think we do that, so eventually the models are all going to have to add up. But I do think this is a good start. And there are some trade-offs you can make, but actually these are the models which the modes really do end up wanting. So if we had done this with the Birch-Murnahan, let's not do that. Okay, I'm going to move on in the interest of time. So we've made this body work, this normal mode model. And it's interesting, it fits the mode data better. It's not perfect. It's formalized with an equation of state, which might not be quite right, and we're definitely not getting mass right. But is it a good seismic model? Well, one thing we can do is look at some phases which really care about the outer core. And this is this family of phases which we call SNKS. These are waves which travel as shear waves through the mantle. They're compressional waves in the outer core. And the number of bounces will give you some sort of label. So if you're going to bounce once, you're going to have SKKS. If you're going to bounce twice, you have SKKS. A higher number of bounces means you have more sensitivity to the top of the outer core. Somebody asked me about these phases earlier in the week, and I said they're a whispering gallery phase. So in order to compete completely with Curtis, you had a Rayleigh 1898 quote. I now have a Rayleigh 1878 quote, where Lord Rayleigh actually talks about these whispering gallery phases and talks about how the phase propagation through around this curved surface of these phases really amplifies and gives you sensitivity to a region. And this study wasn't the first time I'd come across these SNKS phases. These are pictures from CIDR 2010. Okay. This is what we call Team E Prime. You can see we were still big on taking the photos. None of us had camera phones then, so these are actual camera photos. This is at the playground by the beach, and you can see that in this team we had Sana and Rita, as well as a number of other long-standing CIDR participants. And so these are phases that some of us have been interested in for quite a while. As an aside, we had a great time doing this project. We had an AGU poster. Lizzie Day gave a couple of talks at the pre and post AGU meetings. We actually found results which are very similar to what our study has found. We actually found the sorts of minimal physics results. I think we used Abby Kavner's Excel spreadsheet to do some of the work there, and we actually found similar variations would be needed for the bulk modulus and its pressure derivative. So, in 8 years, think about what your team from this year is doing. Team E Prime is doing pretty well at the moment. But what can we do with science? Well, we can take these SNKS phases, which are only really sensitive to a few hundred kilometers below the core mantle boundary, and we can use our epoch model to predict what travel time should be for these SNKS phases. And then we can go into the literature and say, very nice people have published some observations. How well does our model fit these observations compared to other models? So what we're going to do here is compare our model with observations by Helfrich and Kanashima. They had a paper in 2010, and in the supplementary material, they just had a table of their results. So what we've got on this figure here are the results of Helfrich and Kanashima plotted on the zero axis. So if your model looks just like their observations, you would like your model points to plot on this zero axis. We've made some predictions for our model. We've also made predictions for PREM. We've made predictions for IAST91, AK135, and SP6. They're all body wave models. Our predictions are these green bars because we know the uncertainties of our models and have model ranges. We can also give you uncertainties on the travel times. And what we actually find for our model, which is created only using normal modes, we fit those travel time data better than PREM, but we also fit it better than the three body wave derived models. So this gave us some real confidence that it wasn't just a normal mode story we were telling. What we've actually found is a model which describes the seismic properties of the outer core better than existing models. We use no body wave data, and yet we fit the body wave data better than any of these models. I think at this point there was a great amount of excitement in our three-way Skype calls across the continents.
Could you put that as a constraint in the inversion? Forces?
Let me get that. Because it's a very good question, so I have an answer. So, one of the places that these models are different to each other in particular is this top of the outer core. And so what I'm showing you could be referred to as a zoo of models. I think it could also be described as take a bunch of bits of painted string and fling them at a canvas and you will get something which looks like this. These are seismic models with velocity plots relative to PREM, again in orange. We're seeing the core mantle boundary over here. We're moving towards the inner core over here. The radius of the inner core is about 1,250 kilometers, so the inner core boundary is somewhere down there. We're seeing a lot of variation in these models. Okay, that's why it's a zoo of models. None of these models have the same values. Our model Epoch Vinay, again, it's in the same green as before. It's definitely slower than PREM near the core mantle boundary. As are many of these other models, they've all been derived using body waves, and one is a normal mode-based model. And so one thing you might want to say is, do we need this model? right? Do we need an extra layer? These are all made relative to Prem, and they say you need this extra slow layer at the top of the outer core. We're already slow compared to Prem at the top of the outer core. So do we want a layer? Do we want a layer in addition to our model? Our model should be describing a well-mixed adiabatic region, so maybe we want one anyway. And then you might go on to ask, unless you're a member of one of the core mantle boundary groups, you might go on to say, do we care? We should care. So this is a clip taken from a paper by Fern and Loper. This is 1981, so the same year that Prem came out. And they made some estimates and said that there could be a stably stratified layer of order 70 kilometers at the core mantle boundary, just below the core mantle boundary. This topic has been revisited by a number of people. Brzezinski calls it the hidden ocean of the core. You can think about it as a hidden ocean of something a bit different at the top of the core. You can also think of it the place where the scum rises to, if you like. That's less beautiful, but it might be more true. One reason you might want to think about it like that is it could be a layer where you have a lot of light elements accumulating. So it could really be the scum floating on top of your pot of jam. Bruce, I think, has escaped the room, so I can use his name here. So he's done a few pieces of work which suggest that some of the geodynamical and magnetic field observables would quite like to have a stratified layer at the top of the outer core. So here he suggests a 140-kilometer thick layer. A lot of people seem to have jumped onto this 140-kilometer thick number that Bruce published and said, Bruce says it's 140 kilometers. I can now do the rest of my science. It's probably what I would have done. So you can look at Rossby waves. There's a lot of text here because I know these slides are going to be on later. You can look at geomagnetic jerk data. And they say things like this 140-kilometer thick layer that Bruce proposes with a density contrast of 50 parts per million could be responsible for what's seen. 50 parts per million is a very small number. That's about 30 times smaller than the difference between a couple of those density models I showed you on the very first slide. Never mind our model, which is more different in density. So that's what some of those previous studies have been saying. It's important to say that other papers say no stratification, nothing there, don't worry about it, move on. But one thing one might want to ask is, so you have this stratified layer, and it's got this density contrast, and it could be full of light elements, the scum at the top of the outer core. So you expect that to be seismically what? Well, if you've got a stratified layer, this is velocity here, this is up to the core mantle boundary here, Prem would be here. If you're light, you should be seismically fast. All of those models were seismically slow, including our model. This is one of the models that I showed you before. This is one of Ed Garnero's models. And again, if you're full of light elements, seismically fast seems like the way to go. So what can we do? Well, we can look a little bit more at the body waves. People who came to CIDR in 2016 might remember my graduate student, Wembo. This is all his work with these body waves. We learned how to do active source seismic in the winter. My main recommendation is maybe don't do it in the winter. It's really cold outside in the winter in New Jersey. So most of the time you get to stay in his office and look at these waveforms. So we're building a new database of these SMKS differential travel time observations. We have more than 500,000 waveforms. We have a new iterative way of measuring these waveforms. Obviously it's the most beautiful cross-section we have of waveforms because I'm showing it to you. But we see really clear arrivals of the phase which bounces once, twice, three times. We're actually able to make some measurements of the phase which bounces four times. So we're making some really good measurements of these. You're seeing 435 seismograms on this distance stack, so there's a lot of data here. There's so much data that we're actually able to bin it regionally. And for the first couple of bins of data that Wembo measured, I hadn't given him the epoch model at all. I was just like, can you give me your data and I'll make a picture? So again, we plot Wembo's measurements on the zero line, and we plot these points, what Epoch Vinay does. And it seems even with newer data and more sophisticated measuring techniques, we're actually still seeing that our model without a stratified layer can fit the outer core well. So what we want to do to finally answer Nick's question is to keep on making more of these measurements, and then we can treat the normal modes and body waves together, because that's one of these holy grails of seismology, right? To make a model that works with the body waves and with the normal modes. But so far, we seem to be seeing a model where you don't necessarily need this stratified layer, which is good, because it's very, very difficult to explain a layer that's round full of light elements and is seismically quite slow. And so maybe the problem isn't that we need to explain this mineral physics behavior, it's just that Prem wasn't the best reference model to use, and if you use a more appropriate reference model, you take away a need for the layer at all. So to round up, we've used a Bayesian search to find a Vinet equation of state, or a Birch-Moynihan, you can do what you want. We assume that Prem is true for the rest of the Earth, and this gives us mass problems. Our model fits the normal mode data a lot better and has some respect for physics behavior. It's not perfect, it's not the best equation of state, but we don't know what a better one would be. We have a model with a more dense outer core. Excitingly, when we compare to body waves, we maybe don't need that slow layer at the top of the outer core. And so to tie it into some of the themes that people have been talking about through this slider, it's also worth saying that some people wanted to explain the slow layer at the top of the outer core by the residue of the core of a moon-forming impactor being like sludge at the top of the outer core. You don't need to try and explain that sort of behavior if you don't need a layer there at all. So I know there are questions because I can see hands trying to move. So I will leave it there and take those questions now. Thank you very much.
So that might be a bit ignorant question. I don't know so much about fluids, but you said that a stratified layer with a lower density would be seismically fast. And that's true if the bulk modulus would stay the same.
Yeah.
But if it's a stratified layer with dense elements, the bulk modulus is likely different, at least in a solid.
Yeah, so what you'd have to do is let your bulk modulus change twice as much in the opposite direction as your density, just to get that simple relationship to balance. So you could do it. There is an idea by George Helfrich that you do this by non-linear mixing, but it's difficult. But that is the sort of working assumption we would work from.
I was interested in the bottom of the outer core, and I'm thinking particularly of the inner core density contrast and what's going to happen to that now, because that's such an important parameter for driving force of geodynamo, etc. And you've got, I mean, normal modes are going to give you density, but you also have PK will like it, you give you some constraints on that. So what's your thinking?
So our thinking is we would love to know the answer to that question. And that's something we're working on at the moment with the normal mode data. So to start with, when we made this model, we made these really conservative mode choices that said we're not going to let any of the modes we know can be affected by inner core anisotropy pollute the outer core side of the story. And that means that we lost resolution at the inner core boundary, the mode sensitivity kernels, which is something I skipped over. Let's see if we can find them. The mode sensitivity kernels are very small because of the requirements we put on them. So if you look at the mode sensitivity here, this is the core mantle boundary, this is the inner core boundary, and you see that our modes care a lot about core mantle boundary and their sensitivities decay away a lot. And that was due to a choice we made to start with. So the next step is going to be to move on and try and do that. The reason our model still exists at the inner core boundary is because if you've got a well-defined equation of state, you can just carry on projecting it with higher pressure. So our model exists there, and we have error bars for that, but we wouldn't want you to draw any inferences at the moment. But ask us in a few months. We might have a different story. Zach.
I guess while this is up, how important is the fact that you tie the rest of the Earth to Prem for these results? Because it seems like there's lots of places, I mean, you kind of alluded to this, but there's lots of places you could stuff those trade-offs.
Yes. So let me show you a different picture. So there's a whole swathe of stuff that I had to skip over here in the interest of time. One of the swathe of stuff, which is a technical term, is the way we thought about errors. And so the way we assigned errors to the mode measurements, because many of the published errors are very, 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 very small, was to say, okay, well, that's a very small error you've got on your measurement, but what about if we just change the mantle model? What sort of change in mode frequency does that give you? And so we actually took into account the effect of changing the mantle model when we set our errors for the mode observations. So here is one way you could think about that story. What if we just used a different mantle model and done this entire thing, assuming that the STW-105 model was accurate for the rest of the Earth? So STW-105 is actually the backbone model of one of the Lamont Group 3D models. And what can we see if we do that? Well, we still see this slow layer here. We actually get a density which is even higher. We find that there's not a substantial difference when we do this in any of the conclusions of our work. So we can say what happens if we change the model. The values change, but the story doesn't change at all. this is only changing the mantle model. There are very few good mantle density core models of the Earth. There aren't many other switches we could make. People ask if we should use AK135 to do this, but that wasn't... There you've got the velocity model, which wasn't developed in conjunction with the density model. That density model is an ad hoc add-on afterwards. So it's not a self-consistent model to use for this.
The improvement in data fit holds if the rest of the mantle is, if you change...
So when we did this, the data fit's actually worse if we use STW-105 for the rest of the thing. So we'd prefer to keep using Prem for the rest, but what we'd actually like is maybe Raj and Ved's new model. Yeah. Just maybe. We'd like a more accurate representation of the rest of the Earth, because clearly our story isn't consistent with mass and moment of inertia. And it has to be eventually. Scott, I think, was next.
So you had the plot that showed, the error associated with different linear realizations.
Yes.
So how sensitive is your output then to the modes you use? Like, if you took a subset of the modes, would you get a different result?
So one way you can look at what happens when you change the set of modes we have is actually just to look at the change in fit when you consider the modes that care about the outer core. You just consider those modes which care about the outer core, and we could have a semantic argument about what you mean about caring, right? But if you do that, you actually improve the fit to those modes by 70%. So the modes which care about that region actually care a lot. That doesn't mean that you decrease the fit to the other modes. The other modes are okay with these changes. But when you make that change, that's definitely a factor. Because we've done a Bayesian search over all of this, we're actually thinking about a very large number of models. There are a lot of runs that go in here. Basically, the way this works is you snap your fingers and 6 seconds later, you've got a new model. You test it, 6 seconds later, you've got a new model. There are a very large number of models that went into this search. Sarah, you have a question or are you done?
Yeah, I have two questions, actually. So, I would argue that it's very easy to produce a slow stratified layer.
And I wouldn't argue with you.
I'm wondering if you have any insight as to why Helfrich and Kanishima and quite a few others have found an anomalously slow gradient at the top of that arc core. And then my second question is kind of related, is that I'm very excited to see what happens if you look at modes that are sensitive to the base of the outer core. And if you don't see an F layer, for instance, does that mean just that our mantle and crust models are very wrong? Or
so, tackle your questions in order. If you believe that Prem is the reference, then to get those slow velocities at core mantle boundary, you need a stratified layer. If you use our model of a well-mixed adiabatic outer core, which is already slower, then you don't need even slower than that. So if you want to use Prem as your reference, you're definitely going to find something. What actually happens is that our gradient is steeper than Prem already, so that's actually already taken into account, and that just comes out of the modeling. That's not something we've imposed. Which is not to say there's no stratified layer there. What we know at the moment is we don't seem to need one. And as Wembo does more work, more results will be forthcoming. And for the bottom of the outer core, kind of the same as what I said to Lars, yes, we would love to know that too. And as more work comes out, more results will be forthcoming. But those are definitely things we think are important.
Are the body wave studies wrong compared to your model just because of using Prem as a reference?
I would argue that they've not used the right reference, but they've used the only reference available to them.
I'm just thinking about the trade-offs that are there. I mean, we can't necessarily tell the difference between a stratified layer and this difference in compressibility that you're seeing. Because, if we have more light elements at the top of the core, we can see exactly what you're seeing, which is apparently a lower density at lower, and then a greater density at deeper depths. So that stratification may be trading off as well with your K-prime.
There could be some trade-offs. So we've explored some of that trade-off, and we have made some models. But if you can't account for the 150-kilometer length scale behavior on the mantle side, then you shouldn't try and account for the 150-kilometer length scale behavior on the core side. So if all of the lower mantle groups would like to publish their work, we can take your models and put them in here. There are definitely trade-offs. What is also the case, though, is the lateral extent of this is much longer than the 70 kilometers that Fern had. It's much longer than the 140 kilometers which Bruce had.
If I could just add something to that. I guess because now, instead of just having some arbitrary velocity profile that actually doesn't even have correct limiting behavior at high pressure, you actually now have a seismological K and K prime. So if you measure in the lab K prime values that are lower than ours, then you know, oh wow, that's indication
oh,
that this
we
has
should
to
definitely be plotting them right on top of this.
Yeah.
We would love well, that. We can give you everything. It's all in the paper on the supplementary.
Except these are isentropic, so you have to use the Grignard.
But you can extrapolate these to exoplanet course.
Yes, you can. And then we can plot them on top of June's models as well. All of the plotting of all of the models.
Can't you just fit the equation of state, like VS, the equation of state, two param measurements? Like you look at the density,
yes,
volume, you can do that too, right?
With the prem data, you mean?
That's right. Yes.
Well,
that's
so that is.
Wait. There's no data. Right. Prem is a model.
It is a model, but right. You use that model, so you can fit the equation of state to that data, right?
Yes. So we have
okay,
we've done both things. I think there are two different things that you could be talking about. So we've done both things. We've said what if you fit an equation of state to prem. And so in the paper, we compare our bulk modulus, pressure derivative, those sorts of things, to that value. But we can also take the prem data and invert that instead.
But you are actually doing the normal modes, right?
Yes.
The prem data has only the normal modes as part of its data. It has
yeah.
a lot of other data.
So we've just taken the normal modes there, but if you the only thing that's constrained density in prem are normal modes. The body waves haven't helped at all there. And arguably over a vast reach of the outer core, there's very little body wave sensitivity. That inversion was started with the Adams-Williamson setup.
The travel time and the total mass would also give you the density distribution, right?
Total mass could give you the density distribution if you assume that the Adams-Williamson equation is obeyed throughout, okay. Which is the starting assumption that Prem made.
Could you actually use this vignette?
So we tried inverting, assuming that the Adams-Williamson equation was true. That was one of the many, many, many inversions. You can do it. It gives you models which are actually seismically faster than Prem and fit the data less well than Prem. So that is not a good starting model for us if we're doing worse than what was there before. We've tried a lot of ways around inverting a lot of these things, and they're really good things to think about.
I'm confused now, because you are assuming Adams-Williamson, right?
Yeah.
Well, so we're assuming an equation of state, but we're not fitting an arbitrary polynomial where the relationship between density and velocity has to be Adams-Williamson, because that's what Prem did. Prem fitted an arbitrary third-order polynomial in radius where Adams-Williamson had to be obeyed in the starting form and didn't actually get deviated much for at the end. So what we have instead is a different radial formulation, because the formulation is a function of pressure, which you can then...
But you're both assuming Adams-Williamson.
We're assuming it in as far as
it's a more
mineral physics equation of state has it as part of its central understanding. But we're framing it in the equation of state formulation.
Okay.